Monday, October 26. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump and Joe Biden marathon campaign over the weekend with just 9 days to go until the election.
60 million people approximately have already voted, so any sort of October or early November surprise is not going to change their vote.
U.S. COVID-19 cases soar as 5 members of Vice President Mike Pence's staff test positive. Also ahead, the brightest star in the night sky gets a new lease on life.
It's actually so bright that when you take measurements of it, you can see it when the sun is out.
It's all on today's International Edition. With just 9 days to go until Election Day, it's a race to the finish line as President Donald Trump and his Democratic opponent, Joe Biden, spent the weekend hoping to sway the remaining undecided voters. Joining us for details is VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, what were the candidates up to over the weekend and what was their message?
Yes, Lori, I spent Saturday traveling with the Joe Biden campaign, the former vice president focused on the state of Pennsylvania and got a little bit of star power assist at his second drive-in rally of the day in a swing county in a battleground state when John Bon Jovi, the rock musician, showed up and performed 3 songs. So that was a bit out of the norm.
Wow.
But in general, the Biden campaign, at least with Joe Biden, has been playing it very cautious. He is doing nowhere near the number of appearances that President Trump is, nor is he trying to break crowd records, as is President Trump. It is definitely a socially distanced campaign, something that the president has mocked. But in addition to John Bon Jovi, the Biden campaign has other ammunition in its arsenal, such as former President Barack Obama, who was in Florida also on Saturday, and will also be back again there early this week. And he has shown that after 4 years, he still knows how to wow a crowd. Now, of course, Lori, the president has had no difficulty at all attracting big crowds, thousands of people turning out at these rallies in swing states, much to the chagrin of some of the officials in these localities who have called the president's rallies super spreader events, fearing that they're going to cause wider outbreaks of COVID-19 in their communities at a time where in many states we're seeing an upswing again in not only the number of cases, which the president attributes to more testing, but also more hospitalizations for the coronavirus as well.
Obviously, this is a big topic, but both candidates seem to have very stark differences in how they are handling it or addressing it.
Yeah, absolutely. There is quite the stark contrast in the rhetoric between the two candidates. The president, of course, still saying on a daily basis that we're rounding the corner, even though the number of cases and hospitalizations go up, where Joe Biden is blaming the president for many of the deaths we've had in the United States, saying that the Trump administration has never had a plan. And now we're seeing public statements from people such as Mark Meadows, who's the White House chief of staff, telling media on Sunday that basically we're just going to have to let this thing play itself out and hope to combat it with therapeutics and an eventual vaccine, but not calling for stricter policies on social distancing and masks. And Joe Biden has said if he wins, as soon as he gets in as president, he will call for a federal mask mandate for all public transportation and urge governors of states to utilize mask mandates. So quite a contrast.
With just over a week to go, is there any chance that there could be potentially any sort of so-called October surprise that could actually impact the outcome of the election at this point?
One thing you need to keep in mind, Lori, 60 million people approximately have already voted. So any sort of October or early November surprise is not going to change their votes. Where we're really seeing a focus by both campaigns, because most voters are really already committed to one of the candidates, it's more about rallying your base and ensuring that the people supporting you actually do early voting or mail in their ballots or show up on election day. So I don't think any sort of October surprise is going to sway somebody to change their choice of candidate, but it could have an impact on either motivating them to go to the polls or stay home on election day.
White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman, thanks so much. The United States is seeing a nationwide surge in new coronavirus cases with a near record number of new cases on Saturday. Hospitalizations are also rising. New York, the former epicenter of the U.S. COVID-19 pandemic, on Sunday reported 500,000 cases, a two-month high, with deaths also trending upward. The surge comes as there's another outbreak at the White House. Vice President Mike Pence's chief of staff and at least four others have tested positive for the coronavirus, but aides say Pence intends to continue with his aggressive campaign schedule. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Until that day that we have a vaccine available, we're going to keep working to slow the spread. We're all going to do our part to protect the vulnerable, to save lives.
Vice President Mike Pence addressed a campaign rally in Tallahassee, Florida, Saturday, but his closest aide, Chief of Staff Mark Short, remained in Washington after testing positive for COVID-19. The White House says the vice president and his wife both tested negative, and Pence will continue making campaign appearances. A spokesman says Pence does not have to quarantine because he's considered an essential worker.
But Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer criticized that notion.
In the same breath with which they announced that Vice President Pence was exposed, the White House said that he would keep on campaigning, comparing campaigning work to the work that doctors and nurses and firefighters and police officers do.
Meanwhile, many countries across Europe are also seeing surges and reinstating restrictions. The relationship between France and the United States is rarely as far apart as it is now, say experts. As the U.S. presidential election nears, polls show many French are hoping for a reboot with a new leader in the White House, as Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from Paris.
It started off 3 years ago as Operation Seduction. France's newly elected President Emmanuel Macron invited his counterpart, U.S. President Donald Trump, for Bastille Day celebrations. After a reportedly tense beginning, the two leaders seemed to hit it off. But the honeymoon didn't last. On issues from climate change to the Iran nuclear agreement, or JCPOA, to the European Union, they are far apart. Macron supports multilateral agreements such as the Paris climate and Iran nuclear deals the Trump administration pulled out of, and a strong EU the U.S. president is skeptical of.
Macron's earlier efforts to woo Trump came to zero. No success at all. No progress at all. Zero. The relationship is not broken. Trump and Macron do speak when they have to, and there are areas where they can agree on, but they are not getting closer to each other at all.
Last year, Macron described NATO as brain dead, suggesting Washington appeared to be turning its back on the military alliance. The Trump administration says NATO remains critical, but that it wants the Europeans to pay their fair share.
But the French particularly, because they play a special role, a special diplomatic and military role in Europe, they know that they cannot count as much on the transatlantic ally, the American ally, right now.
I think of Trump as a sort of dictator. His opinions represent an extremist part of America.
Polls like this one show generally negative European perceptions of Trump. French and other European citizens support Trump's Democratic rival, Joe Biden, although many aren't enthusiastic about him.
Biden is sincere. He's surrounded by good people. He wants to work with the whole world.
Vice President Joe Biden has already said that if he were elected, he would rejoin the JCPOA, he would rejoin the Paris Climate Accord, that he would try and reinforce the Europeans' trust into NATO.
Not everyone here is anti-Trump. The far-right National Rally, France's largest opposition party, generally backs his administration, along with some conservatives. French-U.S. ties, which stretch back to shortly after the American Revolution, have had low points before, including France's opposition to the U.S.-led military action in Iraq nearly two decades ago. Still, experts say today's differences are more substantial and longer term. Even before Trump's election, America's focus had been shifting elsewhere, to Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America. And they say after Washington's abandonment of key agreements the previous Obama administration signed on to, French and European faith in the U.S. has eroded.
Can we trust the signature, the commitment of the President of the United States? No, we can't. And that's forever, because we know that the next president can undo what has been done in the...
Still, many see the French-U.S. and broader transatlantic relationship as having strong foundations. In areas from cultural to military exchanges, the two sides still work closely together. Ties may have frayed, but they are likely to endure. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Mali would have fallen to the terrorists.
Australia will now allow more of its citizens stranded overseas by COVID-19 restrictions to return home. A weekly quota imposed because of capacity restraints in the mandatory hotel quarantine system will be raised by almost 300 people. Phil Mercer reports for VOA from Sydney.
Foreign travelers were banned from Australia to curb the spread of COVID-19 in March, but citizens and permanent residents have been allowed to come home. When they do, they face a mandatory 14-day stay in hotel quarantine. But there are strict limits on the number of repatriated travellers permitted to return each week. The current weekly quota is 6,000 people, and that will soon be increased to 6,290. It's estimated there are about 25,000 Australians stranded overseas. The federal government wants them home by Christmas and is looking with state and territory authorities at other quarantine measures beyond the use of hotels. Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
Whether that's quarantining in home, on farm, in camp, at a mining camp, on campus, any of these options we'll be looking at and working together with states and territories to both identify and trial some of these options.
The government of the state of Victoria has delayed plans to ease some of the world's longest lockdown restrictions in the city of Melbourne. An announcement on the relaxation of disease control measures for shops and restaurants, as well as strict stay-at-home orders for the city's 5 million residents, had been expected Sunday because of a sustained fall in daily infections. Officials don't know, though, whether a recently discovered cluster of coronavirus cases in Melbourne is contained. Victoria Premier Daniel Andrews believes a prudent approach is needed.
This is not anything other than a cautious pause to wait to get that important information, to get the results of those tests, just to rule out whether there's more virus there than we think.
Melbourne went into a second COVID-19 lockdown in early July. Business groups have said that they're shattered by the delay in reopening the retail, fitness, tourism and hospitality industries. Many restrictions have been lifted or partially relaxed in other parts of Australia as life begins to resemble what it was before the pandemic. But officials warn against community apathy or complacency. Australia has recorded 27,500 virus infections. More than 900 people have died. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In Lagos, Nigeria's commercial hub, the state government has relaxed a curfew imposed last week during youth protests against police brutality. Despite this, many residents are continuing to stay at home after witnessing a week of violence, property destruction, and the killing of peaceful protesters who defied the earlier curfew. From Lagos, Samuel Okocha reports on the current situation and what's next for young Nigerians who had taken to the streets in a global end SARS campaign against police brutality.
Father, The streets of Lagos are buzzing back to life after the state eased curfew restrictions to 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. Commercial buses have taken to the streets while private cars ply the roads. But not everyone is coming out.
I don't think it's safe enough to go out.
Yejide Adeneye is a mother of one, and she's weary of going out. She says there is a tense calm after days of unrest.
I've not even been going out at all, so even though the curfew has been lifted, I still don't feel comfortable going out yet, especially because I have a little one. I feel, you know, I should still continue to watch the situation of things before I step out at all. It's really because, I mean, nobody expected what happened last week. There was no way we could have expected this. So I guess everybody's still trying to lie low.
Unrest escalated in Lagos and other parts of Nigeria after the shooting of the protesters who gathered last Tuesday night in defiance of a curfew to demonstrate against police brutality. Rights group Amnesty International said soldiers and police had killed at least 12 protesters in two districts in Lagos. The army and police have denied any involvement. Over the weekend, Nigeria's police chief ordered the immediate mobilization of all force resources to control the street violence that saw hoodlums looting and destroying public and private properties. President Muhammadu Buhari has called for an end to the protests and said government was already responding to the issues raised. But while demonstrations have ended on the streets, the NSAS protesters say they are not giving up.
The problem has not been solved in the minds of so many people. Not just you, the government just did whatever because they have guns. And now you are telling the people that when next they are coming to fight for their right, they have to come prepared. So we now know one or two things. The tricks of the politicians, the tricks of the government, what they use in suppressing people's voice.
Abio Dauphin is 26 and one of the protesters who took to the streets for 2 weeks demanding an end to police brutality with the NSAS campaign. He says the NSAS protests have awakened the political consciousness of Nigerian youths who are now going to stay active in demanding for good governance.
Let's leave SARS alone now. Anytime we feel that a government official is found guilty of corruption, we can take protest to that person's house for the person to step down until he has been cleared by the court of law. So like that, people now understand that the power belongs to them.
Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
Sudan on Friday became the third state to move toward normalizing relations with Israel. But unlike Israel's recent deal with Abu Dhabi, where hotels are already promoting packages for Israeli tourists, the deal with Sudan still faces several hurdles, including some public opposition. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the normalization deal with Sudan. Netanyahu called it a dramatic breakthrough to peace and said the famous three no's from Sudan in 1967, no peace with Israel, no to negotiations with Israel, and no to normalization with Israel, turned into three yeses. Sudan had rejected Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and said Israel must withdraw from all of those areas to make a Palestinian state. Sudan follows the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in making deals with Israel. Sudan follows the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain into making deals with Israel, with U.S. President Donald Trump saying at least five more are on the way, with Israel hoping that Saudi Arabia, with its huge economy and oil reserves, is one of them. In Sudan, the situation is a little more complicated. Many Sudanese oppose the normalization of ties with Israel, with demonstrators burning Israeli flags on the streets of Khartoum. Sudan is also in the process of transitioning from a dictatorship to a democracy. Foreign Minister Omar Gamal al-Din said that a peace deal with Israel would have to be ratified by a legislative council, a body which does not yet exist. It is not clear when the council will be formed. For Israel, normalization with Sudan would have important military benefits, says former Israeli ambassador to Washington, Michael Oren.
The vast majority of rockets that are fired at us from Gaza are not made in Gaza, they're made in Iran. And they get into Gaza via the Sudan. And it will be the Sudanese relationship, or a peace relationship with Sudan, would have an immediate impact in stemming the flow of Iran, made in Iran missiles into the Gaza Strip. I assume that if missiles are getting in, money's getting in, other things are getting in, it'll be very difficult now for Hamas and Islamic Jihad to import Iranian weapons and other materials through the Sudan. And that would be extremely important to us.
The Palestinians have condemned the Arab outreach to Israel as a new stab in the back for them. As part of the deal, Washington also agreed to take Sudan off the list of organizations that support state terrorism. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Scientists have uncovered some unexpected surprises in their research on a supergiant red star, including when it will die in a fiery explosion. Betelgeuse, spelled differently than the character from a movie with the same name, is the brightest star in the night sky. Joining us for details is Dr. Meredith Joyce, astrophysicist at the Australian National University, who led the study, which was an international collaboration that included scientists from five countries, including Australia, Japan, Hong Kong, Hungary, and the U.S. Thank you so much for being with us. So what specifically was the goal of the research?
In November of 2019, Betelgeuse got a lot dimmer in the night sky. And because we know that it's this supergiant star, people were speculating that it was about to turn into a supernova, so that it was about to blow up because the dimming behavior was very out of the ordinary. So the original purpose of the study was to see if we could do some calculations and some models to figure out why the star was dimming and maybe perhaps predict if and when it was going to go supernova.
What was the conclusion?
So as science often works, we ended up finding out a lot of things about the star besides that. But other studies found that a giant dust cloud had moved in front of the star, which is why it suddenly got less bright. But what our study found was that the star is pulsating regularly. So its brightness is going up and down in a systematic way. And we identified the frequency of those variations and then the physics that was causing those brightness variations as well. A consequence of our results as well was through doing this analysis about its variation behavior, we also found that its rate was smaller than previously predicted.
What does it mean for us here on Earth? Why is this something of interest and that helps in some way?
Yeah, so this is our nearest supergiant star. And so scientists have been kind of waiting and hoping that we would see a supernova nearby for a long time. And one consequence of our study is, first of all, to place the star a little bit closer to Earth. We're still safe if it explodes, but it is closer than previously thought. And it also gives us a bit longer before it goes off. So previous estimates for its supernova behavior were about 10,000 years. So it wasn't going to be a problem for us anyway. But a consequence of our results is that this is more like 100,000 years.
Okay. So we don't need to worry about it exploding, but we know that it's closer. And does it teach us anything else about the universe or the world of space and life on Earth?
So when we're able to derive precise characteristics of stars in the way that we did for Betelgeuse, this actually helps us with exoplanets as well. And that's one way in which this kind of science is directly related to human interests. So what it does provide us is a new way of measuring the physical size of a star, because typically very expensive telescopes and instruments would be used to do this. But in our case, it was just models. It was just pure math where we were able to figure this out. And so this technique could be generalized to other nearby supergiants and maybe give us revised estimates of their location as well. And if we have revised estimates for distances to the stars, that gives us a little bit more insight about, you know, how the galaxy works, how it's laid out, and things like that.
Can this be seen from anywhere in the world?
So Betelgeuse is very bright in the sky. It's actually so bright that when you take measurements of it, you can see it when the sun is out.
How did they come up with the name?
I wish I had more mythology background to tell you, but the other name for it is Alpha Orionis. So that's the Orion constellation, and Alpha being the brightest star in that constellation.
Dr. Meredith Joyce, astrophysicist with the Australian National University. Thank you so much for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here. Mondays through Fridays at 09.05 and 20.05 UTC right after the international news.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA's International Edition continues. AFI Fest, one of Hollywood's most prestigious film festivals and part of the American Film Institute, was held virtually this year because of the coronavirus pandemic. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke to the festival's organizers and filmmakers about the challenges and advantages of the online platform.
124 films from 35 countries were represented in this year's AFI Festival.
We've been interested in diversity. That's important to us. It's important to the programming team.
Just over half were directed by women, such as Nora Martirosyan, a Franco-Armenian director. Her film, Should the Wind Drop, is about an abandoned airport in the disputed separatist enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh.
And this airport indeed exists, and there are people who go there to work every day. But there are no planes that arrive or leave this airport for many years. In fact, the airport, it is the symbol of this desire of the recognition.
The documentary 76 Days chronicles the 76 days of the pandemic lockdown in the Chinese province of Wuhan. Shot by a team of Chinese filmmakers in Wuhan and produced by filmmaker Hao Wu in New York City, the film chronicles the desperate efforts of medical workers to save patients at a Wuhan hospital.
At the beginning of this pandemic, a lot of their efforts were futile because they couldn't save them. They didn't know enough about this virus to truly save people. So this kind of emotional anguish, both on the patient side and on the medical staff side, I feel like it must be universal.
There's emotion in all of these stories that we're all still going through.
There were some advantages of the virtual film festival this year.
The positive side is really just incredibly increased accessibility, where we're able to present films and make them available to anybody in the U.S.
Thinking about economical reasons and environmental reasons, it makes sense. It makes sense to be able to do this and not to have to spend money and taking a plane to travel to another city and blah, blah, blah. But of course, nothing compares with the possibility to be there, sharing with the audience and watching the film in the big screen and everything, no?
In Tragic Jungle, filmmaker Yulene Olaizola presents the Mayan jungle in the border between Mexico and Belize as a living entity that has magical powers on human beings, something, she says, that could be felt much more intimately inside a dark movie theater and on the large screen. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And Texas country singer and songwriter Jerry Jeff Walker, who wrote the pop song Mr. Bojangles, has died at the age of 78. A family spokesman says Walker died Friday after battling throat cancer and other health issues for several years. Walker emerged from New York's Greenwich Village folk scene in the 1960s and was a founding member of the band Circus Maximus. In his career, Walker released more than 30 albums. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for being with us.
Jump so high, jump so high. Then you let it touch down.